So, should we talk about Robert Silverberg, The World Inside?
We should. I want to introduce ourselves, though.
Oh, okay.
So I'm Leonard.
Okay,
And this is Benny.
I thought you were Lanyard.
No, that's not my real name.
Okay.
That's the tool that I most associate with. If I was
Oh,
like a
you're a
simple
master
if I was a
lanyard
simple if I was a
weaver?
simple tool, that's the one I would associate with.
Is a lanyard a tool or a jewelry item?
No. A lanyard is
I thought
any
that was
sort
like the
of.
plastic shit you fold in on itself and it's cool and you give
No,
it to your
it's like
friends.
anything attached to something, you know,
Oh, yeah,
like if you
right.
have your wallet attached to like a little
You're
metal
right.
chain, that's like a type of lanyard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Leonard and Benny,
Leonard the Lanyard
right,
Crosby.
and this is Benny the. I don't know, what is your favorite simple tool, Benny?
I love a good lever.
Benny the lever. Got it.
You can wedge it places,
And this is
get some
the
leverage.
this is our science fiction show where we talk shit about people that are better writers than us.
Okay,
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. So talking shit about sci-fi. Welcome everybody. This is our third week of shit talking. And
Going strong.
the first week we talked about Samuel Delaney and silent what silent essays? Silent
Interviews. Shit
interviews.
talking is a little strong. I thought we were
Okay.
rather,
I'm just trying to, you know, I just want to be popular. Just trying to
right.
keep
I
it
thought we were
edgy.
rather, we liked the we liked the shit we're talking about the shit. I
We're
mean, we liked the stuff.
politely analyzing. This is
Politely, and
Leonard. This is Leonard and Benny politely analyzing science fiction
right.
show.
Yes, okay. What was week two then? Oh, we got a little. What did we do week two? You did your short story.
Yeah.
There's like some wars and stuff. People were dying.
Oh, it was
Cyborgs.
Gardner Dozois' A Very Special Morning
Yeah.
is what we talked about in week two. So if you want to reference those, you can go back and check
Just
out
click right here.
our special
Click here.
blend of
No, you're not clicking the
polite.
right.
There's nothing to click. It's a
Okay.
podcast.
Okay.
I guess you can click back to week two on your little podcast machine.
Enough. I'm excited about The World Inside.
I am. So Benny read the first chapter,
Yeah,
yeah?
it was great. It kind of stood on its own as like a short story, I thought.
I think that that's because it was. So
Oh.
I didn't send you the intro, but apparently the book itself was published in 1971, but he says in the introduction that he published a bunch of them before the book was put together. So just as I was beginning, this is a quote from the preface, just as I was beginning to sketch out a story for Harry Harrison, another famous science fiction writer, who wrote Make Room, Make Room, which got made into Soylent Green. That's
Oh.
Harry Harrison.
So the book that Soylent Green was based on was not called Soylent Green.
No, it was called Make Room, Make Room, exclamation point, exclamation point.
Two exclamation
No, one
points? Oh,
after each
okay.
phrase.
That'd be
Yeah.
pretty radical to be, have two
Well, I mean, it
exclamation
was the
points.
60s. I couldn't go that far.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So he wrote, he says, a sketch that began in March 1969 would become a story that I called A Happy Day in 2381.
Yeah. That's the first line of the story. Here begins a happy day in 2381.
And he says, I learned of the work of the visionary architect Paolo Soleri, who is quite
Oh.
literally trying to design a world built along the lines that I had hit upon. So
Really?
I should have sent you the
There
preface.
is a in Santa Fe where I grew up, we used to have an amphitheater called the Paolo Soleri Amphitheater, which he designed and which I'm pretty sure they demolished.
Well, maybe they didn't want us to go down the route that the book takes place.
Okay, so the route that I understand the book, correct? You've read the whole book?
I've read the whole
I've
book.
only read the first
Should
chapter, but
I
could
read the
I?
back cover? Because it gives like a gist. We
Okay.
can just work our way into it.
Well, I was going to try to summarize based on what I.
Please, yeah,
So in
please
the first
summarize.
chapter, I really liked this
Yeah.
chapter a lot. So Earth is now these giant towers of. Like a billion people in a tower? Not quite, no.
800,000 people.
800,000 people per tower. Each tower is like 3 kilometers
Yeah, it's like 2
high.
miles tall, and it's like, I don't know, four times 1,000 meters on a side or something. Right. Yeah.
And they're all, and you can see, if you get on, if you look out the window, you can see your neighboring towers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're called, they have a name. They're monads. Called monads. What kind of monads? There's a shorthand.
Well, the one that, they're called urban monads.
Urban monads.
The most of the book takes
place. Urbamons.
Urbamons. Yeah. Urban monad 116 is where most of the, the place.
So these are like giant super complexes. It's like the taking high-rise apartments to the extreme.
It's basically an entire city. It's like all of San Francisco,
right?
Put into one single building.
Into a few floors of a building. There's multiple cities.
Well, but per the population of San Francisco is like 700,000.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, right. Yes, but like each neighborhood of San Francisco,
right?
It becomes a couple right. floors.
And people spend their whole lives inside of these buildings.
Right.
They have apartments
that are very small by our standards.
Right.
The main character, who's like a sociologist in the first chapter, he has an apartment that's like...
It said it was...
90 square feet or something?
No, meters. It was 90 square meters. Charles, which I was trying to do that calculation.
9 times 10? So that's about 20 by 30 feet, approximately.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that's right. like the size of your
it's
apartment.
It's like 1,000 square feet.
Yeah. It's like the size right. of your apartment, but he has a wife and like 4 kids.
Right. Yeah.
And they also don't...
I live in a one-bedroom apartment.
Yeah, and they don't get to go... By the way, since you can't see Benny's apartment, it's about...
I think it's like 700 yeah, square feet.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. But there's no... They can't go to Lake Merritt.
No.
They don't get to, like, go outside.
Right.
They're just in this building.
Right.
And the way the society, like, maintains stability is that anybody that rejects it, they immediately get executed.
They get thrown down the chute.
Yeah.
They get erased.
They get erased. They have this system where you fall down a chute that goes all the way to the bottom of the building, and they have, like, an incinerator that, like, makes you into compost, which helps, like, heat the building.
Right.
Yeah.
I didn't get to the part in the first chapter. They don't reveal that you're turning into compost yet, but they do reveal that
you go down the
there
chute.
There is a chute.
Yeah,
yeah. I loved the language too in this chapter. Like, he would. Is it a, who wrote this? Is it a he?
Robert Silverman.
Robert Silverman. Okay, let's go with.
He's a he.
It's like I'm trying to look at the very beginning. Well, there's so in like episode one where we're talking about how Delaney's saying like. There's all this language stuff in science fiction that cues you to there being sort of like a material difference.
Going back to our first podcast. Yeah.
He says in like sentence two, well, I'll just read the first paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Here begins a happy day in 2381.
Which right there, 2381, you know you're in science fiction. But
I love that here begins a happy day too, because like who the fuck would say that?
And it's so satirical, right? We live in the modern world. If this was written... By like the ancient Greeks would be like, oh, they actually are stoked. But like we don't like we know instantly that that means the opposite just because of modernity.
Right.
That's not necessarily a science fiction thing, but to me,
yeah,
any depiction of perfection is obviously satirical because we can't have that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, keep going.
Okay. Here begins a happy day in 2381. The morning sun is high enough to touch the uppermost 50 stories of urban monad 116. Soon the building's entire eastern face will glitter like the bosom of the sea at daybreak. Charles Mattern's window, activated by the dawn's early photons, deopaques. Nice verb there, deopaques. He stirs. God bless, he thinks. His wife yawns and stretches. His 4 children, who have been awake for hours, now can officially start their day. They rise and parade around the bedroom, singing, God bless, God bless, God bless, God bless us everyone. God bless Dado, God bless Mamo, God bless you and me. God bless us all, the short and tall. Give us fertility.
Which sets up basically the entire world.
Right, they love kids.
Well, so it is based on a fertility cult, but from a dystopian perspective, so we talked about this in week 2 about how you define a dystopia.
Oh yeah.
So we're going to go back and listen to that. But
I don't remember what we said.
Well, okay, to recap, the 3 things are it has to be set in the near future with near future technology. and we have that. So the buildings, eastern face, deopaque. So they have some sort of technology that they don't have shades. They have like some kind of light filter.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like technology there.
When was this written?
1970.
That's cool because we kind of have that.
We have that now, but I don't think they had that in the 70s. It's not that fantastic, but it's newish.
Nice prediction, Robert Silverberg.
And then we have the children can officially start their day. So there's this indication of control.
Weird. Mm-hmm.
Right? So then there's
number
two.
How understated it is, too.
He's a talented guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then this indication of satire. One, it starts in the first sentence, but then they're God bless us and give us fertility is obviously a satire on overpopulation.
Mm-hmm.
So we get all of it in the first paragraph and all of it in the first sentence. I think that Delaney would be pumped. He'd be like, you're doing a good job, Rob.
Mm-hmm.
It's all coming together. I don't know if they were friends or not. Mm-hmm. They're actually both still alive.
Oh.
They probably...
We could be the introduction.
I would love to. I would probably pee myself.
But your pee would get recycled. As they do in this book.
We're not there yet.
Oh, okay.
I guess maybe by the time we meet, we'll be living in urban monads, and then I could pee myself, no problem.
So their apartments are small, but impressively conservative of space, right?
Right, so the
TV is, like, in the wall.
Mm-hmm. The bed deflates.
The bed deflates.
The babies have their own, like, little crib in the wall.
Oh, I don't know if I got that.
I don't know.
I like the way they describe the bed a lot. On Principessa's side of the sleeping platform,
that's his wife,
curled against the inflation pedal, lies 14-year-old Sigmund Kluver.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so I love, like, the inflation pedal. There's so much, like, you have to infer, but it's straight. The inference is, like, relatively straightforward and fun to do, I thought. You're like, ooh, there's an inflation pedal for the sleeping platform.
I don't think it shows up in the first chapter, but one of the things I liked about it is that Silverberg goes to great pains to talk about the, like, infant slot, where they put the babies in this, like, slot, which isn't fully closed. It's not like a drawer, but it does all this stuff to, like, entertain the child. So, because they have so many babies, because the whole society is built on fertility, that it saves them time. So, like, they put it in this little box, and there's, like, all these colors and all this, like, TV and shit. It's like an iPod for the baby, so they don't cause as much of a fuss, and everybody can keep banging.
Right.
So I guess the cornerstone of this utopia, dystopia, is this obsession with sex.
Yeah.
They bang all the time.
Right.
And no one is allowed to refuse
a good banging. Yeah.
Right. So
I was, when I was reading this, I was like, I'm pretty sure a man invented this.
Yeah.
I mean, especially because, not because, like, not everyone loves a good banging, but because, like, the fact that you cannot refuse it seems rather...
It's like a man's utopia instead
right.
of a utopia of, like, why don't we just have a world with consent.
Right, exactly.
He solves it in the other way, where it's like, well, why don't you just fuck everybody?
Yeah. It does appear, at least in the first chapter, like, it doesn't... It seems like there's not, like, rape going on all the time. People are just sort of brainwashed into it being part of the culture that we just fuck. But it is definitely still, like, the man is, like, the giver of seed and the one who needs to release. Like, I don't think the women are orgasming in this world.
No, they do.
They do.
There's a couple of sex scenes later in the book where the women are definitely enjoying the sex.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it does have this overlay of masculinity and, like, men-centric nature to it, where in the book the men do what is called night walking, where they leave their wives and they go walk around the city and they just walk into anyone else's apartment and sleep with whatever woman's in there.
And or man.
Right, yeah. So they don't have any taboos about homosexuality.
Right.
They don't do it that much because they are all obsessed with fecundity. But it's not, there's no stigma.
That is a little funny that that part doesn't, you'd think that they'd be like, you can't be wasting your seed on these infertile men.
No, they promote to me, it's like this clash of all these things that came out of the counterculture movement of the 60s. Where on the one hand, he's like, we've got to accept that it's okay to like have pleasure and it's okay to be queer and whatever. And then on the other hand, he's like got this free love thing going where he was like, you need to have sex with everybody. But there's also this overlay of like, Robert Silverberg was born in like the 40s, I want to say. Like, he grew up before second wave feminism. So he still has this idea of like, men are still masculine and they want to fuck all the time and women are just like passive. Mm. Even if women enjoy it, they're not going to go do the night walking.
Although they are, they can, right? According to the rules?
I get, yeah.
But they just don't?
They just don't. Like, it's sort of uncomfortable. And it's not necessarily illegal to turn a partner down. It does happen in the book.
Oh, really?
But it's a big faux pas.
Huh.
Like, you can get reported for it. You can get, like, brainwashed for not conforming.
Okay.
It is almost like a crime. But it can still happen.
Yeah. Other things they don't do is they don't wear much clothing.
Mm-hmm. So they say
they pee and poop in
in front of each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. He says in the first chapter, he's like, they say they're a post-privacy culture.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah.
Post-privacy. Mm-hmm. Can't you, I just can't wait to be in live in a post-privacy culture.
So this brings me to another thing about it, is that
I wasn't being serious.
No. This gets into the things I liked about the book.
Mm-hmm.
One of which was, when I first read about this, because I teach this class on dystopias at Cogswell College, and I'm always like looking for new dystopias and utopias to expand my breadth on the topic. And I looked this one up like a couple of years ago, and the Wikipedia article on it was really lame. It was like, they live in these towers, and everyone is supposed to have sex all the time, and anyone that disagrees gets put down the chute. And I was like, that sounds really dark. But it also sounds like it has a lot of similarities to other dystopias.
Mm-hmm.
The writing in it is really rich, though.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Robert Silverberg is the type of writer that I really like,
mm-hmm.
which isn't to say he's better than others, but he's very good with the language is classed up, but not so much that it kind of interferes with the functioning of an interesting plot.
Mm-hmm.
The plot ticks along at a swift pace.
Yeah.
He's like the type of writer who grew up probably writing not very good pulpy stories, but by the time he wrote this, he'd been writing for like 20 or 30 years. So he's like, I want you to be entertained.
Mm-hmm.
I want this to be sci-fi. I'm not writing like a Joycean escapade exploring language, but I also know what the fuck I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the language is going to be pretty.
Yeah.
Even in the first paragraph where he says Dio Pakes and the entire eastern face will glitter like the bosom of the sea at daybreak. That's, you know, he's got some classy stuff in there. It's not like, it's not maybe classy's not the right word, but, you know, he's having some fun with language. He's not, it's not boilerplate, you know? So that's one of the things. I was surprised at how well it was written and how I was obsessed with it. I read it in like 3 days. Like, I couldn't put it down.
The book?
Yeah.
Wow.
Maybe a week, but it was really fun to be.
The first chapter is
So that was probably the first thing I liked about it. Were there things that you really enjoyed about it, or things that you know?
I definitely liked how understated a lot of things were, like, and all the details that he uses to suggest various things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they turn on the screen in the morning. And it's talking about, for example, here's like a little detail. They turn on the screen, the wall blossoms with light and color. Good morning, says the screen heartily. The external temperature, if anybody's interested, is 28 degrees. Why does it say if anybody's interested?
Like, they must know there's like hundreds of thousands of people watching this, right? Nobody says that on the news.
Yeah.
And this is Joe with the weather. Well, Joe, it's 27 degrees outside. If anybody gives a shit. Okay.
Oh, that's why. I get it. It's because no one would be interested in the external temperature. It's like a vestige.
They like have to report it, but it doesn't matter.
No one ever goes out. I never, that didn't occur to me.
Oh, huh. Now we're learning here. Close reading, everybody.
Today's population figure at Urbmon 116 is 881,115, which is plus 102 since yesterday, and plus 14,187 since the first of the year. God bless, but we're slowing down. Across the way at Urbmon 117, they've added 131 since yesterday, including quads for Mrs. Hula Yabatinsky. So it's just like, I don't know, you're getting like the culture of the place at the same time that you're getting like these like factual informations. I thought it was, yeah, every line is like kind of like surprising and loaded with stuff.
World building.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he does a really good job of showing and not telling.
Mm-hmm.
You could imagine someone writing the same book and it could be very boring.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would just explain this. They'd be like, the Urbmon population has been growing, or whatever. But he just does it like flawlessly because he immerses you in this world,
mm-hmm.
where we're just watching the news.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool in that way.
Also, so then this guy from Venus, mm-hmm. comes, and they have a totally different culture on Venus. They don't do any of this stuff.
It sounds similar to our culture, more or less. Yeah.
And this person is... So on TV, the family, the main family of the chapter here is, in exactly 40 minutes, Urbmon 116 will be honored by the presence of Nicanor Gortman. Oh yeah, also the names are great.
Yeah.
We've got Nicanor Gortman, Hula Yabatinsky, Charles Mattern.
Sigmund Culver.
Principessa.
Mm-hmm.
Jason
Cavado.
Right. Oh, the kids are named Indra, Sandor, Marx, Cleo.
Yeah, I love the one that's named Marx with an X.
Oh, yeah, with an X.
It's not Mark, it's Marx. We're moved from the Bible to
Marxism. Yeah. Okay, so Nicanor Gortman is coming. The visiting socio-computator from hell.
From hell, yeah. But hell is their name for one of the cities on Venus,
right,
which seems nonsensical. Who would name their city that, you know?
But it suggests so much. Like, that's the immediate question you ask when you come
to
that.
You're like, what the fuck? Right. He's mm-hmm. coming from hell?
Yeah. Which to me is like plays with a kind of suspense the whole way mm-hmm. through. It's like you're learning some things, but every time you learn something, there's like a new thing that doesn't get answered. And you're sort of like waiting to learn more about that.
That's what I mean. He's very talented in writing the sort of thriller-esque science fiction.
Yeah,
it's what they call the lake. I don't know if it's a lake metaphor, the lake scheme in writing,
mm-hmm.
where you're always, the character is always swimming farther and farther out of the lake, but they can never get to the bottom mm-hmm. of the lake. They can never quite see the bottom
mm-hmm.
or like see the other shore. Mm-hmm. Anyway, what was the other thing you were going to say?
No. I don't think, I'm just, That was it, I think.
The other interesting thing about chapter one is that, again, it conforms to traditional utopian literature because we have the outsider who shows up in this foreign utopia and then gets a tour.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly the same as Utopia, written by Sir Thomas More, which is about this island in the middle of Atlantic, about this ideal sort of medieval culture.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy who goes from Amsterdam and like shows up there and gets a tour.
Mm-hmm.
He does the exact same thing. It conforms to the genre perfectly, but he does a fantastic job
mm-hmm.
where the outsider is like confused, but he also, it's like meta referencing because he says, so Nicanor Gortman meets Charles Mattern and they, you know, they bullshit about, their work and this and that. And he's telling them about, you know, the civilization and all this sort of stuff. And then he gets to near the end of the chapter, and he talks about the civilization. So this is on page 28. They go onward. Mattern speaks of air conditioning, the system of drop shafts and left shifts, other such topics, the logistics of the building. It's all wonderful, Gortman says. I couldn't imagine how one little planet with 75 billion people could even survive, but you've turned it into utopia, Mattern suggests. I meant to say that, yes.
Uh-huh.
This matter. So he's like, dude, right. I know. I've read the genre. Mm-hmm. I've read Plato, The Republic, all that.
You like those little
references. I like those references. Mm-hmm. It shows that he did his research. Mm-hmm. Or at least he's just like, look, I'm having fun with it. I know the genre's already set. I know there's nothing new to say, but I did another one. This is just a variation on it, so. Mm. Yeah, I thought that was cool.
I don't know whether... I haven't read that many Utopias, but this one struck me as particularly, like, about sex and gender, I guess. I don't know if... Or I guess, well, I was thinking, like, this seems... Maybe this is true about a lot of utopias, but I was wondering, like... I mean, it's, like, it's funny, and it's, like... But it's also dark, because it's, like, oh, God, like... Is this where we're heading, actually? Toward, what? Like, I mean, yeah.
It's always a warning genre.
Yeah.
And actually, most dystopias are about sex.
Well...
That's not something that people overlook. But so, Brave New World, right? Everyone has sex all the time. It's like enforced. Mm. You can't have a partner for any period of time. Mm. Everyone's decanted is the word they use. They're test tube babies, right? All that stuff. In 1984, sex for pleasure is like outlawed. Like people are married, but they're only supposed to be married to have children to be like faithful party members. Mm-hmm. They're not supposed to have sex for fun.
Right.
And We by Evgeny Zamyatin is the classic dystopia from which those are both based on, is all about, it's also about the control of sex, where people get like assigned partners based on their height and stuff like that. But a lot of them are. Like The Handmaid's Tale is another one that's all about issues of sex, or The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin. Not The Dispossessed, The Left Hand of Darkness, excuse me.
Well, but The Dispossessed, it does, I remember... Maybe it's more of a subtle thing. Well, but I remember that when he does his tour, there's a tour in The Dispossessed, too.
That's true, yeah.
Where he's getting the tour, and he's describing all the furniture as, like, weirdly sensual and voluptuous, I think.
And he's not used to it.
And I don't remember whether that is, like, a big point in the book, or if it's just, like, a passing thing that, like, the capitalist culture is the one that, like, over... I don't know what the word would be. Like, over-sexualizes.
Yeah, and they emphasize the differences between the sexes a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a scene where he's having these conversations with the Adonians. I think it's Adonians.
I don't remember what they're called.
So in The Dispossessed, there's a moon, Anaris, which is all where the anarchists are living, and then there's the planet they came from, which are all capitalist and or, like, Stalinist, Marxist. And... he has these conversations with the women, and they're all like pre-second wave feminism, basically, where they're all like, oh, we belong to men, and ha ha ha, we actually control them, even though we don't have any tangible political or social power. And he's really confused by this, but then also he's really confused by their sexuality, because he's like very open about it, and he's very much like, I want to have pleasure with you. Do you want to have pleasure with me? We can have consent, and then everybody will get off. And they're, like, really confused because the women are like, why do you want to have sex with me? What are you trying to get out of this?
Oh.
And he's like, I'm not trying to like, pay you, or, like, this isn't for, like, a political favor.
Hmm.
I thought we were just going to have sex.
Hmm.
He's like, in my culture, there's no, like, trade-off.
Yeah.
This isn't, like, a quid pro quo thing. Right. And the women are in this book are all confused.
Hmm. This is in The Dispossessed?
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember that part.
Read it again. Read it again! It's a classic. Yeah. But The Left Hand of Darkness is all about, you know, it's a genderless society, so it's all about sexuality. But that brings me to the other thing I really liked about this book, which is both, you know, fucked up, but I might as well. I thought it was fascinating because it is almost pornographic.
The book.
Maybe this is only from, you know, a heterosexual male perspective, but I found it to be kind of grossly appealing to, like, a teenage, you know, straight dude fantasy, where you're like, it's this fantasy of living in this building where you can go and have sex with any woman you want. And there's all these depictions of sex in it. Like, in a later chapter, there's a few, like, full-on sex scenes, but there's also other ones where it's like a depiction of, you know, they go into this apartment and the woman's like, okay, let's do it. So at the same time, I found it was part of the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was pretty hot. I was like, it's sort of pornographic because it, like, made me horny. But at the same time, I was a little disgusted, where I was like...
disgusted at your own horniness.
Yes, but also, like, this isn't appealing to everybody. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that if a straight woman read this, she'd be like, I'm a little disgusted by this depiction. And also, there's not any depiction of queer sexuality in it, besides that they're all accepting of it, but none of the characters have any queer sex. There's no outright depiction of homosexuality.
And it doesn't really come up as a topic.
I mean, they're always like, no, it's fine. Like, you can do that. But there's no depictions of it.
But is it like a plot point about anyone?
Not at all. Nobody in the book is gay. None of the characters. So I found that sort of surprising, that depiction, both because it was a little juvenile, but also that it was really effective to want to keep me reading. It's almost like it was like a dystopia, but it's like a... It's almost, and I hate to say this, Robert Silverberg, but it was almost like a good like thriller that you would get at the airport, where like you just kept wanting to read it, and you're like, oh, there's guns and there's shootout, and then like it's like James Bond, and he gets the girl, you know, like it almost had that flavor, but it was still science fiction.
Yeah,
there was always like adventure, like the threat of death or like sex to keep you going. And so again, it was something that you don't usually see in dystopias. And I think
sex appeal?
Yeah, because it's like it was disturbing, right? Because there's, if you're reading it, you're like, obviously, this is a satire. And he's not, like, condoning this. But he's also presenting it in, like, a hot kind of way. Like, hot by, like, pornographic.
Yeah.
Where it's, like, depicting it in a way to turn on a heterosexual man.
Well, that's a... Right. Are you worried that maybe doing that at someone's expense?
Yeah, I think it's crossing this boundary where he's being satirical and he's saying this isn't the society we want, but at the same time, the way he depicts the sexuality is like pornographic to that demographic.
Right. I guess it's either...
So it's like not satirical enough. Like none of the sex ends badly for the men kind of thing. I mean, the one sex... There's a couple of major sex scenes, and one of them... The historian Jason has sex with Sigmund Culver's wife, whose name I forget. I could look it up. And he's like obsessed with her. He's like in love with her. And he goes up to have sex with her finally because he's like scared to approach her. And they have sex. She gets off. He gets off. And then she's like, okay, see you later. And he's like crushed because he's in love with her. But he's also like crestfallen because it's just sex with another person. Yeah. You know? And so it's depicted very, like, I guess usually I'm distrustful of a sex scene in literature if it ends well. Whenever it goes over...
Well, did it? It sounds like this one didn't.
I guess you're right. I guess I shouldn't be talking this much shit. That's the nature of the podcast. But I guess that, like, everybody orgasms, nothing is awkward, nobody... You know, it's like usually we don't read about that kind of sex because stories are about when shit's not going well. You know, there's not very many novels about, like, a great marriage that lasts for 20 years and then they both, like, die happily in each other's arms or something. It doesn't... It's not as entertaining. We need, like, stress. So, I guess I'm just going down that rabbit hole. But I found that weirdly appealing and also disturbing at the same time.
Yeah. Maybe, I mean, I haven't... Not having read it, I don't really know what I would feel. But maybe that's... I mean, sometimes that can be powerful. A powerful kind of critique when, like, you are seduced... without realizing it at first, and then you were sort of like revolted at your own seduction or something.
That was sort of the feeling I had with it. I mean, there is a scene in it. So at one point, one of the characters, Michael Statler, who's a computer engineer, he tells the computer, because he's like he's a programmer who like maintains all the computer programs that make the building function. He lets himself outside. And the rest of the world is all these farming communities where all they do is just like farm like crazy with robots. And the rest of the planet is all farms. It's like the entire U.S. is just farmland. And they send all of their food to the Urbmons. And the Urbmons produce all of their like electronics and robots and stuff. He goes to this community and spoilers, everybody. Sorry. He goes to this community and he meets this woman. And the community is sort of like ours, but it's still a little different. They're much more like sensitive to population changed. They're like the opposite, where they believe in population control.
But they live on the same planet.
Yes.
They just don't live in the Urmans.
They maintain their population, yeah, though, because mm-hmm. they can't... They have to maintain theirs, where the Urmans don't. It's a weird contradiction.
Yeah.
Anyway, he thinks that this woman wants to have sex with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he tries to have sex with her, mm-hmm. and basically assaults her, but she stops him. Eventually, he doesn't realize that she doesn't want to have sex with him until she starts kneeing him in the balls repeatedly.
Oh my god.
Like, he starts to rape her, and she knees him in the balls repeatedly, and he, like, at first he thinks that she's just, like, kinky. But, like her fighting back is, like, this kind of kink, that's the way she likes it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was like, and then my balls started to, like, hurt from being repeatedly slammed into by her knees, and she, like, pushes him off of it. Yeah, it's disturbing.
Yeah.
And then he's like, he apologizes. Like, they have this long conversation where he was like, in my culture, if somebody was, like, looking at you like that, mm-hmm. it means it's time to bang. Like, I've just been immersed in this my whole life, that I don't know any better. And again, it was, like, very fascinating, but it was also, like, disturbingly apologetic for, like, rape culture.
Right.
So, the book is weird in that way.
Yeah. Huh. So it felt, because I could imagine that that could feel apologetic or
he's
critical.
Maybe making, he's making a satire where he was like, you need to wake up and realize that, like, all these women don't want to have sex with you just because they, like, looked in your direction.
Right, yeah.
More people should be getting kneed in the balls, perhaps. Yeah, there's some overlapping commentary in there for sure. So I'm gonna just say that Robert Silverberg is smarter than us, and he's on top of it, and we're just not reading it that well. But he also wrote this 40 years ago, so we've got to give him the benefit of the doubt. It's pretty progressive for that time.
Yeah, huh. Huh.
Yeah, there's some heavy stuff in there.
Well, I kind of want to read it.
Yeah, you should. It's fantastic. I thought I had, like, a final point about the book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember what it was. Something about...
Well, do you think... I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think... Well, would you assign this to, say, students in your class if you wanted to... also have conversations about consent, or no?
I don't know if that's the way I would approach that. Yeah. I think I would probably use a book written by a woman. I mean, we already talk about The Handmaid's Tale, which is, you know, pretty, covers a lot of the issues of second and third wave feminism and the threats against feminism. I would assign it if I was teaching, like, a grad class on dystopias and I could make them read, like, 8 novels. I could have them read this one. If we were doing, like, a subsection on overpopulation or something, this would be a fun one to do. But for, like, undergrads, I don't know if it would ever get... I guess if I got to teach, like, 2 dystopias or something, then I would, but it would probably never get in there.
Yeah.
Part of me would want to assign it, though, because I think they would read it.
Right.
Because it's a pretty easy read.
Yeah.
Not that the subject matter is easy, but, like, it's a page-turner.
For us. Or, like, I wonder if it would be, like, a painful experience for...
Perhaps it could be sort of
abused.
Yeah, triggering. I don't know. It's strange. This was the final point. Was that the book argues that they've interfered with evolution. So this goes back to H.G. Wells and all sorts of utopias talk about eugenics, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Where what they've done is anybody that doesn't like to have sex constantly, basically all the women, more or less, that doesn't want to constantly have sex with anybody that they meet, they get thrown down the chute.
Oh.
So they've been breeding for promiscuity for generations.
Hmm.
So now, really, there isn't... This is sort of like another solution to the problem of gender. Ursula K. Le Guin gives a different one in the Left Hand of Darkness, and Silverberg gives one where he was like, if we just bred out either, you know, people of both genders that don't want to have sex a lot,
right?
Then eventually we could get to a point where it was like, we wouldn't have any jealousy. We wouldn't have any conflicts over, like, status. Because that's the other crazy thing is there is status in the book.
Mm-hmm.
The lower levels,
right,
are, like, the workers, and the upper levels are, like, the presidents and administrators.
Yeah.
But the lower levels, it's frowned upon, but they could technically go to the top level and, like, sleep with the president's wife. And it's totally, it's okay. It's like frowned upon, but it's not illegal. They can still do that. Which,
but you're not allowed to cross, like, constellations.
You're not... Yes, you can't do that.
Constellations are these, like, groups of cities.
Right, you can't go to another Urmon.
Right.
Yeah. Which, okay, that was the one thing that I thought was weird about the book, was they don't have any sexual hierarchies. They have, like, economic hierarchies, sort of, like status hierarchies. But in our world, in every human civilization... status hierarchies always correspond to sex hierarchies.
Right.
You know, the idea of high status heterosexual men having high status heterosexual women, this stereotype of the rich man with the beautiful wife, right? And it's a stereotype, but in the book, what's strange is that he doesn't seem to account for that being a problem.
Right.
Because there's this depiction of certain women in the Urmon are more attractive than others.
Right.
And I was always thinking, well, wouldn't you have, like, all of these dudes lining up outside of particular women's doors?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you put all of San Francisco in this situation, there would be, like, 1,000 girls that'd be like, I can't sleep. Because all of these guys would want to sleep with them.
Yeah.
And he doesn't account for that. So I thought that was weird. It seemed like a strange oversight. And it wasn't necessarily, like, maybe he had just... He was just sort of like the... If you could sleep with anyone, you wouldn't necessarily be so in tune to these, like, genetic markers of stereotypical attractiveness. You would just, like, want variety. It's, like, indoctrinated in you to just sleep with lots of people, not, like, particular people.
Mm-hmm.
So...
But he doesn't say that explicitly.
He doesn't say that explicitly. It's not really made clear. And he doesn't say explicitly what they're breeding for, if this is genetically... You know, if they're manipulating their genetic pressures or whatever.
Yeah.
So, well, if you read it, we can continue the conversation.
Okay.
We should probably wrap up the weirdness.
Okay.
And talk about Motorman. We talk about Motorman?
Yeah, I guess we could do that. I kind of was just thinking that maybe it's enough to talk about. It's nice to have a little focused on one thing. Okay. But we could talk about Motorman. We could split it. We don't have to. You know, we could split it up later. Cut it.
We could do episode 4, is Motorman.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got some questions, but okay. I still need to read the first chapter.
Oh, what are your questions based on?
My questions are based on the 4 pages you sent to me. I also have generic questions about the story.
Yeah.
But no, we can save them.
Okay.
Do you have any other thoughts about the world inside? Anything lighthearted? It got really dark. And
well,
like,
it's pretty dark. You know? I mean, yeah, in the first chapter, you learn that, like, I mean, it kind of seems like a book kind of about rape.
Yeah.
Even that it's read by us today or something.
Yeah, well, it's not supposed to exist. It's sort of like the solution to problems with sexuality is that there is no consent because everyone consents.
Right.
And anyone that didn't...
Consent is killed.
It's killed, yeah. And so by the time you've gotten to this point, they're all gone.
Well, except periodically people show up who are like, they're called, what are they called?
Flippos.
Flippos,
they go,
yeah.
Flippo, yeah.
Right.
And they get killed. But there, you know, there's a scene in it where this husband and wife, the historian and his wife, they're having an argument about how they both don't like their society and they're worried that they're going to get executed because if somebody finds out. And... The guy in the first chapter, Charles Maynard, shows up to sleep with the historian's wife in the middle of the night, and they both tell him to fuck off.
Oh.
They're like, get the fuck out of the apartment, we're in the middle of some shit, and he freaks out. And they both end the chapter where they're like, dude, he's totally going to report us, we're both going to get killed. And she's like, Charles won't report us, he's a little bitch, like, it's fine, I'll fuck him tomorrow. And they don't get reported, like, it works out. So, I don't know, there's at least some overlap of, like, they have some sense of humanity in that way. There's still, like, the people that are closest to us, like the historian and his wife, who don't fit perfectly, they're on the cusp of being executed, they still exist. So there's, like, hope that humanity could be restored at some point. I got another positive note.
Well, but hold on. I was just going to say that it's almost, like, troubling that they still exist. Because, like, I mean, this world is particularly painful if people... from our year and culture are living in it. Like, the only way that it can be not awful is if everyone truly does consent all the time, which is, like, what they're going for. But I feel like the point is that you're never, like, you're going to continue to have to throw people out. Like, there's yeah. something that is just not working for...
Yeah, well, I guess I wasn't expecting this to get as dark as it was, but...
Well, it goes where it goes.
It goes where it goes. Sometimes mm-hmm. you gotta get dark. I hope somebody got some laughs out of this. I sure didn't.
I got a few nervous laughs.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Oh, gosh.
But I liked it reading that first. I mean, it's rich.
Yeah.
It's rich and troubling.
Yeah. Damn straight. Robert Silverberg, everybody. Round of applause. Well, I think that's probably about the end. Mm-hmm. So next week, maybe we'll do Motorman. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be lighthearted, right? It's going to be all chuckles.
Maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
It'll be a little more... It'll be absurd. Absurd chuckles,
I like perhaps. That. I like absurdity.
Okay.
Yeah. Maybe less sexual assault, less overriding social commentary on the inherent problems of gender.
Yeah, I think maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
You can always get there if you want to get there.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you can borrow this.
Okay.
And maybe we can, finish up our conversation another time.
Okay.
Good
night, Lanyard.
Yeah. Good night. Wait, what was your nickname?
Oh gosh, I don't remember.
Benny
the lever.
The lever, Benny the lever.
Yeah. And Leonard the Lanyard.
Saying until next week. The Benny and Leonard Polite Commentary Show. Checking off.
Bye.